here we go.
Welcome back to Here We Go with Todd McComas. If it's your first time here, then it's not a welcome back. It's a hello. How are you? Great to meet you. I'm Todd McComas. This is my podcast. Here we go. We just interview cool and interesting people, or at least people that I find to be cool and interesting. And today is no different. Today, I speak to one of my favorite musicians in the world, Ryan M. Brewer. Some of you will recognize him as the person who I'm always giving shout-outs to for writing intro songs for my podcast. He didn't write the one for Here We Go yet, but he did write for Dockheads, for Four Life Podcasts. You know, those were two that you guys really loved. And there's a reason I asked him. The guy writes incredible lyrics. Like, I'm so wrapped up in the lyrics, which I never do that. I'm not even a music person, really, but I love what Ryan M. Brewer does. He's also a funny dude, just a great dude. And he's a Hoosier. So I don't want to waste any more time piping him up. I'll let his conversation pipe him up for you. I'm super confident that you're going to love him. So here we go.
Here we go. Here we go.
Ryan, thanks for being here, brother.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, anybody that's listened to me for any amount of time on these stupid shows of mine knows that you're one of my favorite musicians. So definitely of, would you say you're singer-songwriter genre?
I sing and I play songs and I write the songs that I sing. So I feel like singer-songwriter is as accurate as it gets. Genres scare me anyway, you know? Yeah. I have a little genre phobia going on. I'm always concerned that, like, if I pigeonhole into one area, then I'm like, now I'm that now. And everyone has a preconceived notion as to whatever that thing is.
Amen. You know,
is there a comedy equivalent?
For sure. Like, once you become a prop comic or something like that, it's hard to get.
Yeah.
And it definitely for voice people, like impressionists, like Frank Caliendo is battling with that. He tried to get back to his roots of like, just let me do some regular stand-up comedy.
Regular stand-up.
And people were like, what the fuck?
Give us the impressions.
Where's Madden? We need, you know.
Right. Yeah, so that would be similar. Yeah, I'm afraid like you get into that thing and you're like, I'm an acoustic folk musician. And people are like, well, I know what that sounds like. And
right.
Either have time for you or I don't.
That's interesting to keep yourself artistically outside of any box that people try to put you in. I still get it somewhat. Like, it's hard for me to get away from my cop stories. But, you know, it just – sometimes people were like, ankle gun, you know, during my shows are yelling out bits. And I'm like, it's kind of retired that stuff. But yeah, I'll tell ankle gun for you.
Right.
So
it's always the same. Is it, do you find it's always the same bits that they want to hear?
Yeah.
I think there's something to the type of person who's going to yell out something at you. They also have a certain taste.
Yes.
It seems like no matter where you are, if you get somebody who's got the balls to yell, it's going to be the same bit they want to hear.
Absolutely.
It's always that. It's always that.
There's a couple staple bits that, you know, they grew up knowing me on, and I would be attached to those forever. And they're like, but it's the same way, I think. Now, this is different, I think, in music. Like, obviously, artists can live on those hits forever.
Long time.
That must be frustrating at some point, but like with you, even, you know that I love, what's the title of the song, but the one about Johnny Walker, I Sleep All Right. Like, I'll never let you get away with that. That's my favorite song of all time. So,
yeah, I get I Sleep All Right almost always. And then there are a few others that don't make sense to me that I get like regularly. People be like, numbers and names. And I'm like, that's a weird commentary on like the federal government. Why do you want to hear that one?
So where did music all start for you? You're from where originally?
I was born and raised in Alexandria, Indiana. And then 7th grade, we moved to Newcastle, Indiana. So like, for reference, Alexandria, or Alec, as locals call it, You always know someone's from Alexandria if they say Alexandria or Alec. If they say Alex or Alexandria, that's an outsider.
Okay.
That's not someone from around. It's like E-L-E-C-K. That's the appropriate pronunciation.
And then you moved up to the big city of Newcastle.
Yeah, so like 5,000 people in Alec, and then like what, 12,000 or something like that in Newcastle. So like, yeah, Newcastle is relatively, you know, a metropolis.
Mm-hmm. And where do you call home now exactly?
I live back in Alexandria.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was on... long story short, I was on my first European tour. I'm sitting in Germany, and a girl that I knew from when I was a kid in Alexandria just started following me on social media. And I, you know, being me, the awkward person that I am, I think my first message was, "Why are you following me?" I think was the first message that I sent. And then now we're married, and she's an insurance agent here in town. So I'm back in Alexandria.
Well, good for you. We're glad to grab you back up from the coast, from the industry cities,
from all over the place. I was all over the place for a while. I was a bit of a journeyman there for a bit.
Is it different? Well, all right, let me backtrack a little bit. I want to know how music all started for you. Obviously, you're a very musical child, but how did you first fall in love with it, realize that you were so talented, and then how did you eventually make a move into, I'm going to make my living this way?
Well, my folks were youth pastors, and I think this is such a common story for musicians. Like, I was in the church, and what do you do in church other than like try not to fall asleep while the guy talks and sing? That's like what you do. So I was always performing at church and doing those kinds of things, because if you were performing on the stage, you didn't have to be sitting in the crowd trying not to fall asleep while the guy talked, you know? So I was like, this is my way out of
Let
the
him move.
This is my way out of the boring. I can do this singing thing all day.
Yeah.
So I was always trying to perform in the church, and eventually, but it never, I always wanted to be a soccer player. Like, up until my senior year, when your advisor, what do they call them? Not in high school.
Like your guidance counselor?
Yeah, your guidance counselor. And then in college, it just becomes an advisor. My guidance counselor was like, well, what are you going to do for your living? I was like, I'm going to be a soccer player. And he was like, well, what if that doesn't work out? And I was like, that's just going to work out. Like, I'll go wherever I got to go. Like, I was ready to go semi-pro in some far off land and work as a, you know, grocer in the meantime.
Yeah.
But that was my whole plan.
So you were really good. You were a good soccer player.
I mean, I went to college for it.
Okay.
And the night before our very first scrimmage, my freshman year, some buddies said, "Do you want to go to a skate park and ride your scooter?" Because I rode my scooter back and forth to class and practice and stuff, like a little Razor scooter. And I was like, "Yes, I do want to do that." And so I went and broke my ankle, and that was the end of the soccer thing. Like the coach, like I went through a rehab and came back the next season, but there was never like, and once you're there and you've signed your scholarship and there was just a bad relationship, and it soured the game for me. Like I got to a point where I didn't watch it and I didn't play it and I didn't give a shit about it. And so roundabout would have been sophomore year of high school, music started to at least become a thing that I knew I could get attention for. Mm-hmm. Right. And as a kind of a weird, awkward soccer playing, skinny, lanky high schooler, I was like, man, I can get attention if I can sing.
I mean, girls really love musicians.
It's a stereotype because it tends to be true.
Right.
I think
it's very grounded in truth.
It is. There is at least a sizable kernel of truth at the core of that rumor. So yeah. So I started doing that, but I never thought, like, my folks were like, my dad was a teacher and my mom ran a daycare out of our house. So like, we didn't have a whole lot of money. There were four kids, and my parents were like, we're not paying for you to go to college. So if you want to go, you're going to have to figure out some way to do that. And I had, and my dad high school basketball coach, I had seen it happen before, that you could play sports, you could be good at them, and then you could go to college. Like, I had seen that happen, sure. But I had not seen anybody like be like, I know how to sing. And then a school would be like, here's a scholarship. I had no way.
Maybe Juilliard or something.
Juilliard, you know? Yeah.
There's a few exceptions.
That kind of stuff. Like that happens. Yeah. But like I did, but like John Mayer came out, it like dropped out of Juilliard and released his first record. I was like, I don't know. Like,
right.
I don't know that I'm ready for that at 17 or whatever. So like, so I never saw music as being like a thing that I could do other than just a way to get attention. Mm-hmm. And so, when I broke my ankle, but I did play in bands and I wrote songs and when I broke my ankle, I kind of didn't have anything else to do. So I just kind of leaned into the writing songs and it just found that like, I would go play a local show or whatever, and I'd be opening for somebody with just me and my acoustic guitar, and I'd be talking to other songwriters, and I'd be like, "Yeah, well, I wrote this song, and I got this other song," and they'd be like, "Man, like I realized I was prolific at least. Like I realized I was writing a lot of songs compared to everyone else who kind of just did this thing for attention, you know?
Right?
I was like, I just do it for attention, but I got a lot of it, and because I had so much of it." Like it's a numbers game with songs, right? I'm sure it's the same way with jokes. The only way to write a good song or a good joke is to write 1,000 shitty songs or jokes. That's the only way. And like eventually one of them is good. So because I just had so many, I was able to pull the best ones out. And so my song, say what you will about my voice or my performing, but my songs always tended to be, you know, better than most of the people I was playing with.
I can't agree more. And I don't know what you even call it. Like, I keep referring to you as a superior lyricist. I don't even know if lyricist is a real word or not, but it sounds good in my head.
That's the right word.
You're such a storyteller, and your lyrics, I find usually when I listen to songs, and I'm not even a big music person. Like I'll drive 8 hours in my car to a gig and never listen to a single song. Not
really
listen to music at all. I just, unless it's you or Clayton Anderson, a few other people that I really, you know, clinging some Tom Petty, whatever. But like, I find myself really listening to your lyrics versus just zoning out and just enjoying the overall, you know, song in a general sense. Like the beat, it makes me feel, that's usually how I consume music, right? But I find, I'm really fascinated by your lyrics. Like when you wrote Dockheads, the intro song for Dockheads, the podcast I used to have. Like when that came, I was like, oh my God. Like, and everybody would mention, they're like, this just sums up everything about what's cool about documentaries so quickly. And it was so sharp and just boom, 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 on point. Like it was beautiful. And I find all your songs to be that way.
I appreciate that. I really do appreciate it because I spend time on that. Like that matters to me.
Yeah.
It matters to me because I think, it's possible to say something and influence people and like have an impact on people's lives through all forms of art. But I think music has a special way of going about that. If you're watching a movie, you pull out all the soundtrack, it immediately becomes a worse movie, right? You're listening to a podcast or you're watching a documentary and you pull the music out and all of a sudden it kind of sucks, right? Mm. So music has this like singular power to be influential. And I kind of realized it somewhat. You know, there was a period of my life where I was on the road all the time. Like, just come home for weeks at a time and I'd be back out again. But I was playing a lot of shows that I didn't get any fulfillment out of because it was just me playing songs. I would be in a bar playing for 2.5-3 hours and I would have to play covers and I would have to play songs by other people. And I realized I'm getting no joy out of this because it's about standing on a stage and telling a story. Mm-hmm. It's about the performative act of, you know, of telling a story.
Versus
just being on the stage, making some noise. And some people really get off on that. Like there are dudes I know that will just go to open mics just to play Tom Petty songs so that people in the crowd will be like, oh, you can sing well and you can play the guitar and you knew that Tom Petty song. Here's your applause. Right. And for me, I can do that. But I don't like it. Like it doesn't give me the same kind of high that standing on stage and performing a story for somebody does. And I kind of realized, like, I don't really want to be a musician so much as I want to be a songwriter. That's what I want to do. And I like to perform. Don't get me wrong. I love to go into the studio and record. I feel like I love to be in the studio. There's something great about, you know, taking the song and stripping it all the way back to its kernel core of truth and then try to build back onto it. And there's that, you're walking that tightrope between too much to get away from the song and not enough to really make the song, you know, stand on its own.
But does it start with the story then for you? Because, I mean, you are a storyteller. I would fashion you as good a storyteller as anyone who is a great storyteller in comedy or that's a writer. So is that how the song starts with you? It's like, you know, there's the story, or is it music first and then the story comes after?
There was a long time where I would just sit down and write and write and write. This was in college and just out of college. And mainly I was sitting in class writing, just stream of consciousness, just let the idea take me where it takes me, just writing and writing and writing, just filling pages and pages of notebooks with just writing, aimless writing. And then, and that was when I was in a band, and I would kind of take those to the principal guitar players, the two of them. And I would say, okay, here's some stuff I've been working on. What do you guys got? And they'd give me riffs, because back then I didn't fancy myself any kind of a guitar player at all. Like, I could do it, but I didn't think I was good at it.
Okay.
So I'd go to my bandmates and they would give me riffs. And then I would take those home and I would just get out the pen, like the whole write drunk, edit sober thing. So I would just write endlessly and I would take these riffs and just whack, 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 whack away at all the lyrics until I got something that I felt like could be a tune.
Right.
And then I would take it back to them and be like, okay, this is what I got. So then once I started to kind of go out and do things on my own and play guitar and sing myself, I kind of got to a point where I was playing around the house more often. So I'd just be playing and something would happen and I'd get a line or I'd get a word or I'd get a topic or whatever. And I'd play until my mind had something. And then I just kind of sing nonsense words until something happened. Mm-hmm. And I was of this theory that if I didn't ever write it down, if I came back the next day and I could play it again, then that meant it was something. If I forgot it, then it must not have been that important. Oh, wow. So there was a lot of years where I didn't write anything down. So it would become like time to release a record. And I just have to sit down and be like, let me write these lyrics out for the first time ever for this record.
Oh, see, I will lose it. And even if it's gold, like I will lose it if I don't put it in my phone, like immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. I have gotten recently to a point where I kind of got out of a lot of that. And I wanted to go back to there was a lot to be said about the idea of just freely writing and then going back through and hacking away at it. So I tried to get back into some of that. And now I kind of have a hybrid, I guess, where I'll still sit down and play a guitar until I come up with some kind of a thing. And then I'll take that thing and write it down and see what comes after it.
Wow.
So that's kind of been the hybrid solution that I've decided on lately. And it's been fun. It's been fun to just, you know, like there's something to be said for being Taylor Swift, and just having more money than God,
right,
and, more influence, than most politicians. But there's also something to be said for just making music how you want, in what way you want. And that's kind of what I get to do. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, but, no, that's really cool. And to still make it, and people don't realize too, maybe they do, but now more so than ever, maybe. But like to be just an artist and be able to make your living at it, you're in the major leagues. Like I know people like to look at John Mayer or they like to look at Dave Chappelle or whatever medium you're talking about and think those are the people that made it. But do you know how many people, will, you know, are good?
Right.
Musically,
right,
and comedically,
right,
yeah, don't get to make a living at it. They got to go, you know, be a bartender somewhere and then maybe get to do this every now and then for $100, $150.
Yeah. Yeah.
So to be able to do it professionally, I mean, that's already you've won, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It feels like victory at that point.
Yeah.
And I think that we're in a really interesting spot as a human race, I suppose, because technology has gotten to a point where consuming large amounts of music makes sense now, right? Before it was very difficult. If you wanted to listen to music, you had to go to the record store and plot through all these big giant wooden crates. And there were just white sleeves with black records on them and a yellow label. And that was it. Like, you were just like, oh, this seems like it might be a thing based on the take it home and put it on your. And if it sucked, you're just like, now I just own this shitty record. Right. So like, fast forward to now, like, you can be like, oh, there's this record I probably am not even gonna like, but I got time. I'm driving an hour down the road. I'll just throw on this new record by who the fuck ever. And if it sucks, who cares? It was right. $7.99 a month for all of recorded music in the history of mankind. Like, so it's very easy now to kind of devalue the music idea. And I think comedy gets hit with this a lot too. Mm-hmm. There are so many streaming platforms. There's Netflix and there's Amazon and they're all doing stand-up specials all the time. So when it comes down to like, do I want to go and pay the money and buy the drink, the minimum drinks and do the whole thing? Or do I just want to pop on Netflix and watch the new one by who the fuck ever? Right. It gets easy for the listener to kind of devalue mm-hmm. that experience and that connection that you have of like going in and actually living in the songs, living in the stories, living in the jokes, living in the whatever with that right. person face to face. I think it's easy for people to kind of devalue that. And I hope if anything positive comes out of the quarantine is that people kind of have this realization that, holy shit, I do miss that physical interaction, that like actual relationship you can have.
Yeah, I think, and I totally agree, because it is weird. You put out an album and then next thing you know, you see people sharing the tracks individually through Spotify or whatever to everybody. And you're like, oh, okay, wait a minute. You know, that's not yeah. Amazon Music. You're not, you know,
yeah.
But in the, there are royalties for listens, but it's not, you know, it's you're not getting much.
Fractions of pennies.
You know what is interesting in comedy, at least though, like if you get adorned by Sirius XM for like a year, I had a year where they liked three of my bits and they played them on Raw Dog, like over, you know, it, like you can make 20 grand a year in comedy right. that way, but right. only through SiriusXM. It doesn't translate over to those right. streaming platforms. So what is the equivalent to that musically? I mean,
it's been really important to get like featured on a Spotify playlist.
Oh, okay.
Like if yeah. you can get featured on one of those, Spotify gives people this playlist and tells mm-hmm. them this is what you should listen to.
Oh, wow.
You can rack up everything. You can rack up a million listens really yeah. easily. Now that's not much money relatively, yeah. but it starts the snowball rolling, right?
Sure. Because, and it gets you out there.
Yeah. And artists can now, we have like, you have your artist, readouts or stats or whatever that you get every month that like tell you this is how many people listen to you and this is where they are and this is, you know, what age group they are. And so that then you musicians, and I'm sure comics as well, can go to Cleveland, Ohio and go, look, here's my Spotify numbers. I have 20,000 active followers in your, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like people can use those numbers now. So I feel like if you can get featured on the right playlist, you rack up a million views, but then you a million streams, but then you can also use that to kind of snowball into other performance opportunities. But
right.
lately, there are no performance opportunities.
Yeah, that stinks. I mean, it's killing all of us right now. We'll come out of it, but it is. I wondered how similar it is, because it is. I think for people like at our level, like me, comedically and you musically, it's about the live performances. So it's all everything else is like. It built around that. So it's I got podcasts, I got, you know, all this stuff that's swimming around outside, but in the middle, there's me on stage and as many things as I can put out there to pull people to yes. where I'm going to be on that stage. That's mm-hmm. where things financially change, where they yeah. turn around.
Yeah. That's why this thing has been so hard, is because not only are you're missing that anchor, right? That mm-hmm. anchor in the middle was the live show. It was the tour. It was the performance. And all this other shit was just to pull people into that live. Now you're like pulling and you're like, where do I pull them to?
Right.
You know, people start listening to my podcast. What am I really just going to keep having them listen to the podcast for $0 for me? how do I pull them into, and I read an interesting thing one time. It was like, used to, you would try to get You try to get 100,000 fans, or you try to get 1 million fans who are all willing to spend $10. Mm-hmm. Now you're trying to get 1,000 fans who are willing to spend $100 a year mm-hmm. on you. That's basically yeah. what you're doing. You're trying to get them to buy into your Patreon, or you're trying to get them to buy into every record and every t-shirt and everything you put out so that you can just make that money in larger increments from fewer amount of people. Like, it's about finding that hyper-focused niche that you're like, these are my people, and they're willing to really keep me on in the
box. You nailed it. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about the marketplaces that exist today for entertainers is that if there's anything that's new to the industry now, like in our lifetime, it's that you truly can be this preferred artist for this niche group of people. I mean, mm-hmm. if you have 10,000 people that are behind you, then yeah. you're great. You know, yeah. if you have 10,000 people that are really fanatical and really enjoy you, really love your stuff, then you're set. 5,000, yeah. you can do it. 1,000, really.
Fine. Yeah. Yeah.
And
depending on what they're spending, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know how that could have existed before. You know, I heard stories of, you know, these little cult followings of groups, but never like this, because now you can reach everyone.
Yeah, it's more possible. It's simultaneously more possible and also less possible. Right. Like, you think about everything down the line to, like, think about how expensive it would have been from a comedy perspective. Think about how expensive it was to record an album, a live album, 15 mm-hmm. years ago that yeah. sounded any good.
Yeah, and now it's $20,000.
Now it's not that expensive because you've got a laptop that can do it, and you've got an interface, or you can rent one for not that expensive because they're not that expensive anymore. And microphones aren't expensive. Right. And so, like, you can do things now for much cheaper. So that, what does that do? That kind of takes away the gatekeeper. So the major labels don't exist, but also the shackles of lack of technology also don't exist.
Right.
So it kind of takes away the gatekeeper. So now everybody's got a fucking record out now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. everybody's got a podcast.
And everybody's got a podcast.
And everybody sounds great. They all sound like they're, you know, professionally produced.
And it all sounds super, super in the pocket there. Mm-hmm. And it's just not, you know, there was kind of a time, I think, at one point where it was enough that you just had good sounding shit. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you may not be the funniest person on the block, but your record sound fucking great.
Right.
You know, and then it's the same with music, you know, like mm-hmm. these people just had the money to go into a studio and record a nice sounding record. And now, like, I recorded Exorcism in this very room I'm sitting in right now by myself. Like, it's just,
Isn't that incredible?
It's a crazy world. It's a crazy world that we live in right now.
It's such a great album too. I mean, I love all of them, you know, and they're all available on Bandcamp and through, we'll put a plug at the end for where to find all Ryan's stuff. And then we'll be in the episode description as well. But, I mean, I feel like that's something, not that you don't do this on all of them, but you really poured your guts into.
The most recent record that kind of, you know, I had a record 2 records ago was called Addercism. And Addercism is kind of the idea of inviting your demons in, right? Exorcism is trying to get rid of them. Addercism is like, come on in. I feel like there's something maybe I can accomplish with you here that I wouldn't be able to accomplish otherwise. So I kind of teamed up with the depression, I guess, and wrote a really sad record called Addercism. And then, so, you know, a couple years on, I wanted to write Exorcism, and I was like, I want to write the opposite kind of record. I want to write a record that's like, I'm not teaming up with this depression anymore. This is me telling these stories. It's kind of like that Seinfeld I'm telling you for the last time special that he did. Uh-huh. It's kind of like that. It's like, I'm telling these stories for the last time, and then I'm moving on to something else now. So it was kind of like, it's kind of like the old heave ho there. So there's a lot of honesty in those.
What were you going stories. Through personally at that time to motivate you to want to do it that way? Was there something that,
when Addercism came out, when Addercism came up, I had been in a relationship, for 10 years, 9 years, 10 years, oh, something wow. like that. And, we were never married or anything like that, but we very much cohabitated the whole time, and it was really very serious. And And then it kind of didn't work. You know, like two people can be devoted to each other without being in love with each other. Right. Sure. That's kind mm-hmm. of a thing that I think you, and when you share enough life with someone, you're intensely devoted to that person, regardless of whether you can stand to look at their face.
Right.
And, like I've, you know, we've been in the trenches together. We've been battling through life together. Like you are like family to me.
Yeah.
Even when I can't stand you. Right. And what happened was she got to a point where she couldn't stand me. It kind of gets stretched out to a point where you're like, I don't want to leave. Also, if you're dating a musician and you've been dating him for long enough, you're like, he's not going to be able to survive without me. He'll certainly die out there on his own. Without me as an anchor holding him down to earth, he'll end up in a gutter somewhere. So she kind of had
sometimes that responsibility can turn to resentment, even if it's right. Just believed.
Even if it's just a perception, yeah. It can still tend to be that way. And to be fair, there were a few years where things were out of hand. Sure. but she, you know, she kind of got to the point where she couldn't stand me. That's what happened. And eventually we kind of went on a break and it didn't very much feel like a break. It felt like a breakup. And so that whole period of time is when Addicism came out. So there are songs on that record like Archaeology, which are, you know, kind of the metaphorical idea that when you break up with someone, you're like, I don't even remember what the fuck we were fighting about. Like this has turned into a breakup. So now I've got to dig through years of bullshit to try to get down to the bones of like what this relationship used to be, because I'm the kind of guy where like I can have a breakup like that and you can react by going, what a bitch. Or you can react by going, what the fuck did I do? Like, how can I not be that guy anymore?
That's so such an interesting perspective, because now like you describing that, I'm picturing like the arson investigator at the scene of the fire where there's just ash and rubble. Like,
yeah,
clearly there was a fire here.
And they got their little brush out.
Yeah. But what caused the fire? Yeah. Cause you know, like you're having to dig yourself through like, oh, yeah, what did I leave what the bacon it? On the stove?
Right. Right. What the hell actually happened?
Yes.
And you can't really just move forward being like, the Addicism period of my life was very much a period of my life in which I perceived that things just kept happening to me. I wasn't doing stuff. Things just kept happening to me. I didn't invite it on. I didn't, you know, stuff. I just felt like life just kept happening to me. Uh-huh. And that's unhealthy. And so eventually that's part of the reason why I wanted to write Exorcism. I kind of wanted to write it from the perspective of like, nah, man, I was involved. I was there. Like, I was at least, you know, I was at least influencing the experiment by witnessing it, right? Like, I was at least there. And so kind of the Exorcism is kind of about being like, okay, this was a two-party system, and it took both of us to get this fucked up, right? So, that's kind of where that record comes from, but it's also, you know, kind of symbolizes that. And that's it. And now it's done. And I feel at least in that area of my life, I feel actualized now.
Wow.
You know, like I was out of that thing and it makes sense. And I assume she's fine and doing great because she's very smart and capable. And I'm great and I'm married and have a kid on the way.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting. It's
how do you feel about that?
It's a wild
being a dad.
It's a wild ride. It's a wild ride. I feel like I'm very much in, I'm in spectator mode right uh-huh. now because, you know, I did the part that I had to do.
Right.
And now she has to do a whole lot. And so, you've been here. You're like, what can I do to make up for not having anything to do with that part of it?
Right. Yeah, like, my job's pretty easy.
Right. I feel like I have kind of enjoyed it, in fact.
Yeah.
And I feel like I should be doing something. So I find myself just like volunteering to do weird shit that I've like never like, just, you want me to carry that over there? No, not really. You don't have to. Okay. I just thought I'd check. You find yourself trying to justify your existence a lot, I think.
Have you reached the point yet in the pregnancy where you're having, like, you're going to the classes or any of that stuff?
We start January 4th.
Okay. Now, will that be virtual now, I assume?
Yeah, it's virtual. It's our half of our appointments have been virtual. Okay. I did get to go and do the whole ultrasound thing twice, and so that's cool. But most of the other stuff has been virtual. And at least as of now, I think I get to be there for the act.
Do you know the sex?
I'm finding out.
Yeah, good for you.
Just doing the surprise thing. We have a gray room that the baby's going to be in. So we're just like, yeah, it's not worth it. And you don't, you save yourself. If you don't find out, you save yourself from the bullshit of every extended family member and friend you've ever had sending you some fucking outfit that now you're required to put the kid in that outfit and take a picture of it and post it to the internet. So they could be like, your Uncle Steve got that for you. And you're like, fuck, I don't want to do any of that. So if we just don't tell anybody the gender of this child, then we don't have to deal with a bunch of fucking gifts that we don't want.
Yeah.
It's different having kids. It's different having a kid than when you're 35 than it is when you're 20, I think.
Yeah. When you're 20, you're just kind of, I was young when I did my part to help bring him into this world. And at that point, you're just scared. You're like, oh my God, you know, you're kind of in shock. I feel like probably at 35 is the optimal age because you already know who you are as a person. She knows who she is.
Oh yeah. I was a lump of cookie dough at 20.
Right.
Are you shitting me? Like, no fucking way. I didn't know shit about anything. I didn't know anything. I would have just been like the whole time as a dad, just like, just my hair on fire, just running around. But like now I'm like, I mean, I know it's going to change my world. I know it's going to be, I get all that. But also, like, I'm just not worried about it. I'm like, hey, I've lived a lot. I've had a lot of ups and downs. And I'm feeling like I'm going to keep having ups and downs, except for there's going to be this little thing I got to put food in its mouth. Like, it's going to be the same. It's got our team, our dynamic duo of my wife and I is now going to be a trio. And that's fine with me.
It's a trade-off, I think, when you're an artist because, you're going to lose some sleep. But also, you're going to gain some songs. I mean, now you have something new in your life.
I feel like some of the songs that Jason Isbell's put out since he's had his kid have just been just stellar.
There you go.
I feel like I got some tunes coming down the way, but I'm the oldest sibling of my family. And so, but all the other ones had kids before me because they all, got respectable jobs and did the respectable thing. So I've been uncle many times over.
Yeah.
And when uncle is, like not on tour, everyone assumes that uncle's not doing shit.
Right.
So like, he's not doing anything. I have him come over and watch the kids. And then my mom ran a daycare when I was in high school. It's like, there's just always been kids and babies around me.
Are you now to the point, since you were the artist in the family, where you're like, hey, yep, told you motherfuckers, it was going to happen. Like,
told you I'd be all right.
Yeah.
I told you I would be fine. I would work it out eventually.
And now your child gets to be the benefit of being the baby to the grandparents. What a coveted position that is.
Right. See, my wife is the youngest in her family. So she's always been baby. And there's like a 10 between me, the oldest, and my youngest sister, there's 10 years. Mm. And there's like 8.5 or 9 between her and her oldest sibling. So like, we're on opposite ends of that spectrum. Like, she's been like, I miss being the baby.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And she's like, so now I'm going to have the baby.
Yeah. It's all working out.
But I was the oldest. So I'm like, I never got to be the baby. Not really. Not when I remember it. Right.
Now you can experience it through your own child.
Now I get to just live vicariously through that little spoiled shit. It's going to be just destined to be a little spoiled, precocious fucker, I think.
For sure. For sure. I want to play right now. I want to insert, like, you can send this to me so I can put it in here in the middle.
Okay,
but cool. What your favorite song from Exorcism? And okay. I just want to put it in here at the kind of the halfway point, let people see what it's about so they can go grab this album for themselves. So what song are you going to introduce to us?
This is a song called Aphrodite, which I use, you know, Greek mythology to explore things about, you know, male female relationships in 2020 and the Me Too movement and consent and those types of things, you know. What all just a barrel of fun. It's just a barrel of fun. But that's the tune, and I'm real proud of it.
Wow, well, I can't wait to hear it. Here it is, Aphrodite.
What am I doing right now? The gutters are clean, I raked all the leaves, but I mean, where am I? I'm shaking, I feel like breaking all the glassware in the cabinet. If this is the life, they can have it, 'cause I don't want them to see me falling on my Aphrodite. Shaking from the love you're making. I know whatever he wants, he can have it. Did you offer it up or did he grab it? 'Cause you didn't want him to see you falling on your knee. Aphrodite.
Do you have other ventures too, or is it all music for you at this point?
I just finished my last other venture. I was for the last couple of years, I've been doing, I've been teaching college classes at Purdue Fort Wayne.
Okay.
So Purdue's never had a music program before, despite being, you know, the massive multinational institution that it is.
Right.
And so in Fort Wayne, the Purdue campus is right right there around Sweetwater, and Sweetwater being the most massive, you know, music equipment retail spot in the world. Really, they're like massive companies. Like, they wouldn't believe, like, guitar companies and keyboard companies that do 70% of their business out of Sweetwater, out of Fort Wayne, Indiana. Just an insane amount of stuff comes in and out of that place. So anyway, Chuck Surik, the super loaded dude who owns Sweetwater, as like a sole proprietorship. The guy who owns Sweetwater owns the whole damn thing, by the way.
Wow, that's incredible. So,
yeah. Yeah. The dude, just like every time they sell a guitar, just bing, 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 just lighten up, just lighten up. So anyway, he has a lot of money, and, you know, then he has time to spend it. So he actually endowed the position at Purdue Fort Wayne to have a music technology program there.
Oh, cool.
So a friend of mine kind of came in as the director of the program, and his position was endowed by Sweetwater. So they had this partnership, and eventually they grew the program to a point where now on Sweetwater's campus, instead of Purdue's campus, on Sweetwater campus, there's the Purdue Fort Wayne Sweetwater Music Center, which is a million-dollar studio. And
That's a big deal.
And a great program. It's a really cool program, and it's Purdue's first music program. And so you can get a degree in popular music technology, and you can also get a degree in popular music songwriting. And so I've been teaching songwriting classes and computer skills for musicians classes for the last few years.
Well, that's cool.
So I started off doing just songwriting, and then kind of got into doing some other stuff.
So even though that's another job, it's music. I mean,
it's music. Yeah.
And you're teaching.
And it's primarily songwriting and talking about things that I love. And it unfortunately just didn't ultimately end up working out to be a long-term thing that I really want to do beyond, you know, kind of bridging a gap.
Sure.
And we got a kid coming, and I think I'm going to be mostly stay-at-home dad/musician. So, yeah. My wife owns her own business. She owns her own insurance place. So, she works during the day, and I'll go play songs at night, but I'm going to be stay-at-home dad otherwise.
That's the dream, brother. That's the dream.
I'm pretty excited about it, I got to tell you.
And now you're breaking out into podcasting. You've got so you and Michael Malone, who's I'm friends with as well. He's a very talented comedian. He's very funny.
Yeah.
And he's, creatively speaking, he's into a lot of stuff. But you have been friends with him for a very long time. Where did you guys first meet?
We actually met through his ex.
Okay.
I knew Hillary first, and Hillary and I met through music. She played keyboard and sang. She's great, by the way.
Yeah.
She played songs, and we played a few shows together. And so I kind of knew her, and she had always said, you know, at shows, you know, my boyfriend, Michael, he's a comic, you know, meet him someday, blah, 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 whatever. So fast forward a year or two, I guess I was on the road, and I was coming through LA, and I was like, hey, I would love to stop and crash with you guys. So I don't have to sleep in my car. and she was like, yeah, that'd be great. You can come finally meet Michael. And so, she introduced us that night, and I think she walked around by herself while Malone and I walked around and bullshat for the next 48 hours or so until I left. And then he and I have been pretty close ever since. And so pretty regularly, we have him being in LA and me being back here in Indiana. We just call and talk for an hour and a half about whatever. We talk about politics. We talk about social shit. We talk about our jobs. We talk about our lives, whatever. And, at some point, I don't remember whose idea it was. I'll just default to him and say it was his idea. Malone was like, we should just record this and do it as a podcast. And so I think he did bring it up, and I was like, yeah, we should do that. And then he, because he's Malone, got distracted by 1,000 other fucking things, you know, just like, you know, just wrote a book in quarantine. Like you do. The government's like, you got to stay home. And he's like, okay, I'll write a book.
Yeah.
About comedy? No, about self-help. You fucking weirdo. So he's like, we should do a podcast. And I kind of was like, that's kind of a fucking bright idea. And so he got distracted by other things. And I just kept calling him every once in a while. I'd be like, hey, let's do this podcast. Let's do this podcast. Let's do this podcast. So finally, we actually called each other on the phone and set up microphones. And we literally had a phone conversation into our microphones and then sent the audio back and forth and spliced them together. And
nice. Well, and it's called speakerphone. So
it's called speakerphone because it's aptly named. Leaning into that whole telephone call thing. We hope to have you on. We're looking to branch out into the idea of speakerphone : three-way calling. And we're hoping to have a guest. So we hope you'll do that at some point.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Yeah, I'm happy that you guys are teamed up because I enjoy you both, you know, obviously for different reasons artistically. And I've been friends with Michael pretty much since I started comedy, it seems like, I think. Mm-hmm. So 11, 12 years in.
Yeah.
And, I think that because I met you through him. I had an old podcast out of Morty's comedy joint that nobody was listening to, but you were kind enough to come on with him in a panel and you sang some songs live. And everybody, you know, it was a live podcast. So there was an audience and they just fucking loved it. So I've been following you ever since. So I have Michael to thank for that. And that's just kind of how our little world of entertainment works. I mean, it's all about your fucking catalog, man, your library of people that you've come in contact with.
Yep. It really is. It really is. And I think that's the most fun because I think going back to, we were talking about how easy it is relatively to get into the business now, you know, everybody's got a record. You can put out a record. You can go play at the bar down the street when there's not a global pandemic, but everybody can kind of get into it. And because there are so many people that are into it, you're bound to find some people that you get along with, which is nice. Yeah. Right. And then you have that added camaraderie that comes along with like just recognizing certain things, like the fact that you're in comedy and I'm in music. Those are different disciplines, but we experience a lot of the same shit. Right. So like, we could be like, I was on the road the other day and this happened. You're like, whereas you tell that story to a civilian and they're like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Right. Yeah. Road dogs get it. It doesn't matter what industry you're in. If you're a road dog, you're a road dog.
Yeah. I mean, you just know what it's like.
Shitty hotels and, you know, not a lot of money, a lot of Denny's in your life.
Peanut butter sandwiches, because you can buy a loaf of bread and a thing of peanut butter and it just lasts forever.
Right. So tell me, like, what things scare you, would you say? Like, I'm big on what motivates people. What scares you?
Death? Death scares the fuck out of me. You know what else scares me? Space. That's my most irrational fear. I'm terrified of space.
Really?
I have nightmares that I'm in space. Like when Tesla's like starts like, oh, he's going to shoot civilians into space. Now, how much would you pay for that opportunity? I'm like, I would pay you so much to not let me have that opportunity. I'm terrified of space. Just like a vast expanse of nothingness, which is probably like a metaphor of like my fear of like being alone or being ignored.
I think it probably is. That's the ultimate vast lonely environment.
Wow. And unknown and completely unknown.
When I see
these
movies and shit, even real thing, like astronauts are like, they go up there to be alone or just two of them for a year. Like, what? Dude. That's prison, bro. You just signed up for prison.
Like my armpits start sweating and I start getting itchy when I just think about those scenes where they just walk outside and just like have a fucking screwdriver or something. And they're just like floating in space and screwing a screw. I'm like, fuck that screw. I wouldn't be going out there. There's no way.
Bro, you know how quiet it is. It's going to be a quietness like you've never experienced before because you're in a vacuum.
Did you see, like NASA had these like that. I don't know what the fuck, because I don't understand science. I like words, but science is very confusing to me. Science and math. They had these like devices that could record the energy that was in space. And they basically like converted it to like, if this was on an audible spectrum, this is what space sounds like. Like if it wasn't in so much of a vacuum and there was actually like air moving, what would space sound like? Have you ever heard those?
No.
Dude, it sounds like,
but I feel like I need to get some mushrooms to do so.
It sounds like the eeriest ambient music you've ever heard. It's just like, ooh, like it's fucking wild. Wow. It's wild. Space is terrifying, man. Terrifying. Yeah. Like when the government came out and was like, like, yeah, there have been UFOs. I'm like, duh, there's infinite space out there. Of course, in infinite space, some fucking body could fly by us.
Yeah.
Of course. Doesn't surprise me at all.
Me
space
either.
Is terrifying. Space is terrifying because you can't know anything about it. Same thing with death. We just don't know. It's like, is it absolutely painless and then you just cease to exist? That's terrifying. That like finite, like it's the end. It's over. You're done now. You don't exist.
I guess I never thought of it as like, I'm not afraid of it. I don't think yet, but I've always been fascinated by death because I've seen people die. So I see just the body go lifeless and you don't even look, you're not animated anymore. You look weird. Like light left you. A soul left you. You can tell now you look like a mannequin.
You just look like just pile of meat.
Even the skin looks different immediately when the life light goes out. Right. So I'm always like something left this body. Where does it go? And I'm dying to know
what happens. Is it just in vast nothingness?
And with you, it's scary because it's like, it's going off to something like space.
There's
and it's
just like space.
Yeah.
You ever done DMT?
No. I haven't. I probably will at some point, I imagine.
I want to. I can't imagine not doing it, but at the same time, I'd have to be in the perfect place. Like it would have to be right space, right people, right environment, all that.
I agree because I am scared a little bit of like opening certain doors within myself. Yeah. Like, you know, I feel like, oh, maybe I should leave that alone. I don't remember that being great, you know?
Maybe I am the psycho that I've been terrified that I am.
Really afraid of that. But everybody, and I'm kind of like, it's kind of like revisionist history. I think sometimes when people talk about how wonderful it is and all, and you know, how they're enlightened now, that maybe they're just choosing to leave out a lot of terror that occurred.
I feel like that's probably the case. Like there was a period of my life where I absolutely loved mushrooms, like just couldn't get enough of mushrooms. Like, and by that, I mean like, probably I did them like 3 times a year for about 2 years, 3 years, something like that. So I just did quarterly shroom trips, you know? a lot of the microdosing makes a lot of sense to me.
I was talking about that the other day.
Like putting like tiny little trace amounts into a capsule with like some THC and some other things and popping them in as like a vitamin.
It allegedly does remarkable things, like especially if you're a person who suffers from depression or something, like it helps combat that, like a few other things from what I'm told. Like, and you don't feel high or anything because you're microdosing. You just feel better. And I'm interested in that.
I'm really interested in it. But I loved shrooms for a while. And did you get into the shroom thing?
Yeah, I've done it. Yeah.
This is my description of shrooms. And anytime anybody who's not done shrooms, this is how I describe it. And you can tell me whether you think it's accurate. Most people do. My mind my mind separates into two. There's one half of my brain that is experiencing things. And then there's the other half of my brain that's like translating it and putting it into words, right? Ooh. And they're separated by like the Berlin Wall. Like there's a wall between them. But the one side of my brain can catch the shit and throw it over to the other side. And the other side is just picking things up. The problem is the side that's experiencing things is experiencing it faster and more vividly than it ever has before. Mm-hmm. But it's also just tossing things over a wall and hoping the person on the other side catches it. So it's just like, I'm just sitting there just smitten with the whole world. Like I couldn't be happier. I'm just like, oh my God, everything is something. And which means it's not really nothing. There's always something. Everything is something. And then there's people who are picking it up on the other side going, things. He's got things right now. That's the best. Happening. Yeah. Happening. Things are happening. You're right. And I'm just like, uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. That's the best I got. But I'm just experiencing things like just more vividly and sharper and more accurately than I ever had before, but I cannot put it into words. And then a few hours later, I will be able to. eventually.
It's much like that for me. And I've only done it a few times and with very good, like a guide with me, Sean Latham, right. very experienced, very good at like, just do this. And then an hour later you do this. And, you know, so it was, I felt like I was under the perfect conditions, you know, to do it. Like nothing could go wrong. And it really, it crept up on me at first. You know, I was just like, ah, I feel kind of, invincible right now. I feel pretty fucking great. You know, it's like, I just feel good. And then with the second little dose, then I started to really experience like colors and, you know, just everything just more intense, like you described. But then also I had this weird connection with the earth that I'd never had before. I was like, dude, why I'm part of these trees. These trees are part of me.
Natural and unnatural take on a completely different definition.
Yes.
Right? Like you could, there can be a thing that comes out of the ground and you're like, nope, that still seems unnatural to me.
Right.
But you're like, no, but this chair feels very natural. Like it feels, this feels, I feel very, I always felt like my very first time that I ever took shrooms, I'm sitting there and I'm just like kind of waiting, you know, for things to happen. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm going to go take a piss. And I got up and I went to the bathroom and I was standing there. I had been living in this place, at this time with this girl for probably 2 years. And, I'm in the spare bedroom or spare bathroom and I'm taking a piss and I go, Hey, hon. She's like, yeah. And I'm like, has this bathroom always been a really pale green? And she goes, yeah. And I was like, huh. Man, I thought it was like off white. Like, this, oh, it's been green this whole fucking time. That was my very first time doing shrooms. And I proceeded to have the best time of my life.
And you laugh like you've never laughed before. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you just feel great. I don't know how anybody really can bad. Surely someone's had a bad experience on them, but
I've had a bad trip.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. I had one time when I did shrooms, I went and gathered my two dogs and went to my bed and laid down and covered myself up and told myself I was going to die. I was like, this is where I die. This is how it happens. I die here because of these shrooms. And that is a bummer. And I just like laid down and I closed my eyes and I laid there for like, I don't know. Hey, who knows? Time doesn't exist when you're on shrooms.
Did you feel like the ancient Egyptians? You're like, I'm going to call in all my household pets into the crypt with me.
I live with my girlfriend whom I love and these two dogs. They'll never leave my side. I'll bring them in, put them on the bed with me. And I'm just going to lay. You know what? I lived a good life. And I closed my eyes to die. And then I went, you're not going to die. You just took shrooms, you idiot. And I got up and went and got some water and like proceeded to have the best trip of my life. But that first bit was rough. And I was convinced. Have you ever been certain you were going to die?
I've been close before in a weird, this might be the moment. I think I'm probably going to die here today. Yeah. And it's that fucks with you for a very long time afterwards.
It does. Because you're like, this is how I would respond if it was time. I'd just go gather my dogs and lay down in my bed. Okay. All right. One time I was on the road in it was like in March or something. And we were coming through the I was by myself and I was driving through the Rockies. And I didn't anticipate that it would be snowy in the Rockies at that time of year. I just didn't, it didn't even cross my fucking mind. And I had the baldest fucking tires. I was like, when I get back from this run, I will change my tires. Right. Mm. And I had the baldest fucking tires and it just came this absolute snowstorm and I'm at the top and I'm driving up and my car just starts to go like it stops ascending. And just like, it's just, and I'm like, this is how I die. I die here. This is how I die. And I eventually threw it into neutral and backed up into the embankment on the side of the road when no one was coming.
Wow.
On the highway, like into the kind of the guardrail and kind of just sat there because as I was on the side, I realized I'm on the side of the road, but I'm still sliding backwards. That's how steep this incline is and how slick it is and how bald my tires are. So I kind of like turned it into the snow on the side of the road. But I was convinced I was going to die that day.
Did you even reach that point where you got kind of calm? Like you were that certain, like, all right, well, this is it.
No, I was still freaking the fuck out. I had my wife, now girlfriend, or then girlfriend, I had her on the phone. And I was like, I don't think I'm getting out of this one. I don't think I'm getting out of this one. And I just kind of just backed into the side there, and eventually got settled down, and I used the rumble strips. Kind of like I got out to the rumble strips and kind of used them to gain a little traction, and got rode the rumble strips up over that ledge. And when I came down on the other side, there was a gas station. I pulled in there, set until it stopped snowing. It was terrifying.
Wow. I remember a buddy and my, we were riding to work together, and we were on this State Road 1 that goes from Lawrenceburg, Indiana to the interstate, basically. It's like a little 8 mile, just terrible hills, curvy.
Yeah.
It was black ice that night, and we hit a sheet of black ice, and his car just starts spinning. And I see a semi coming at us. It's the middle of the night, late at night, and I'm just, I was like, well, there's no way we're not dying.
Right.
It's right here. It's coming. We're dead.
Yeah.
And I just got calm about it, and I couldn't speak. I was just like, all right, here it goes. I hope this is okay. And then next thing I know, we're in this yard, and we come to rest between these two trees so tightly that we couldn't even open our doors to get out. Like there wasn't that much room between these two trees. Like we just kicked a field goal. And somehow the semi didn't hit us. And then Rick and I both were kind of just shaken. And he looks over and he goes, thank you for not screaming and panicking through that. And I was like, oh, I couldn't, bro. I was accepting my fate. Like I was making peace with my God. I couldn't speak.
Oh,
and he goes, how did the semi not hit us? And I go, so there was a semi. And he goes, yeah. I was like, I thought maybe I was imagining something, like, because how are we not dead? And he goes, I have no idea. And to this day, neither of us can explain how the fuck the semi just seemed to magically just pass right through us.
Oh my God.
I mean, the interior of the car, Ryan, was filled with bright light. Like the headlights were that close.
Like it was going to hit y'all.
It's almost
and somehow it just,
like God pulled his hand up there and just jerked us real quick into this yard.
Oh my God.
And it almost scientifically didn't make sense with, we were just spinning. How did we suck down this hill?
Right. How did we end up in, no way.
It's one of the creepiest things of my life. Something I will remember, like it plays in my head like a movie that vividly.
Yeah,
like
you just
I'll
remember,
never forget.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I always wonder, I'm like, what happened that day? You know?
What really happened?
Did I just experience some Twin Peaks shit? Like, you know, that had deeper meaning than I realized.
The driver of the semi just
stared
at you all the way by.
He's like, you're welcome.
Got a light.
Yeah,
Twin Peaks is some wild shit, man.
I know. That's why I was like, oh, maybe I needed to be a better person and be more appreciative that I'm alive right now. And then we just worked this thing out with this ghost semi driver.
You fucking visited the White Lodge for a moment, and then were dropped back down into onto Earth, and you took it for granted.
Yeah. Well, dude, this has been great. Thanks for hanging out with me. For sure.
For sure, man. It's been fun.
Yeah. Let's talk again soon. And thanks for always staying in touch with me and helping me with my projects whenever I ask.
Sure, dude. It's a lot of fun to do jingles and stuff. And you've always got new jingles you need. So
I'm always moving, bro. Make sure you check out, guys, RyanMBrewer.com for all things Ryan M. Brewer, Giddy's new album, Exorcism. And make sure that you subscribe right now to Speakerphone with Ryan M. Brewer and my other buddy, Michael Malone, because it's great. These guys are great. You got very talented musician, very talented stand-up comedian. It's always comedian, but I like this mix, and I think people will like it too. You guys have a really good dynamic when you go back and forth.
I appreciate that, man. Yeah. I think we have a good time, and it only gets like morbidly political from time to time. Most of the time.
Michael likes a good political debate.
He does like a good political debate. Yeah. But just this most recent episode, we spent a lot of time talking about getting jerked off by a horse in the woods. So, I mean, it's not always.
That's more in line with my podcast.
So, you know? Yeah.
We do a lot of jerk off talk and space talk, by the way. You would like the space talk?
Talking about a hoove job. We're going to get a hoove job in the woods.
Ryan M. Brewer, everybody. Get to know him.
Thanks, man.
Oh, here we go. Here we go.